This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net. Join us every day at freeenergynews.com as we put up our news. Our special today, we have Dave Mucko of Sky Built Power. He is the CEO. This is a company that I once called a plop-and-go technology, where they put solar panels and wind turbines and basically a plug-and-play type of system into these shipping containers that you can basically deploy anywhere you need in an emergency setting or a portable type setting, and you can basically order what you want inside that pod. You can actually drop it from an airplane with a parachute, from what I understand. It takes two people half a day to deploy it, and you're ready to rock and roll. Dan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you on. Did I get that pretty close?
You sure did. We haven't dropped one of these out of a parachute yet, but I've got a former Air Force general on our board who says it can certainly be done. You have to be careful where it lands if it's got a few thousand pounds of batteries. But outside of that, we think it's quite doable.
Uh-huh. So have you ever dropped one just to test it, or is that yet to be done?
That is yet to be done. What we've been focusing on are lots of other markets and needs that are not quite so esoteric.
Uh-huh. Well, what is your primary market right now?
Well, it might be helpful maybe give you just a little bit of a background on why we created the company, and that kind of would lead into it if that would work for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
When we looked at some of the major trends around the world, kind of the big picture at 100,000 feet for the energy industry, we saw that while there are excellent components out there of all kinds, solar and wind turbines and batteries and generators and, you know, various other devices, strangely enough, there was not a very simple way to plug and play those together and get them up and running quickly. But there was a huge need for that. If you look what's happening now in Iraq and Afghanistan, in lots of areas, the military has operations. They need really reliable, very reliable power that can be mobile and rapidly deployed. And if you look at Homeland Security needs, they've got a similar need too. And one-third of the world has virtually no electricity, and one-third has somewhat intermittent electricity. World wants to go green. Corporations want to go green. So while you have this tremendous need, we were looking a couple of years ago at why hasn't more of these really good renewable products been deployed. And one of the reasons, as we looked at it, was that there's just no very simple plug-and-play, expandable, mobile power system that can use anybody's products and can have sort of an open architecture as far as an operating system. Because almost every day, as you have on your excellent shows, Free Energy Now and Free Energy News, There's a new innovative product. There's always a better solar panel or wind turbine or battery or whatever out there. So we wanted our customers to be able to take advantage of all of those developments. And so what we thought we were seeing there was somewhat similar to the computer industry, where many years ago they had a lot of good components, but it was too complicated. And until, you know, things like the Macintosh and the IBM PC came along. And now a three-year-old can type a letter to grandma, and it can be plug-and-play and portable and so forth. So we used that as a model in the energy business and said, why can't we just make renewable energy as simple to operate as you know, some of the simpler systems used for very portable computers.
Where'd you come up with the name Skybuilt?
Well, we originally, I'm a lawyer by trade and a businessman and so forth, and so obviously one of the first things you do when you start a company is you take a look and you make sure there's a name that nobody else has so you don't infringe on them. And we originally were thinking in terms of Sunbuilt, and started looking at that as a name when we first formed the company about 3 years ago. But the more we thought about it, the more it looked like Skybuilt was more appropriate, because it's not just sun, but it's also wind and lots of other things involved in the planet. We were a leading renewable systems integration company, so we work with all forms of free energy, if you will, to help to minimize the use of fossil fuels and hold down the costs for the customer whenever possible. So we found that was a good available name, and we've been using that ever since.
You said a couple of things that piqued my interest. Number one, you used the phrase free energy, which I take it you're using it in the same way I use it, which is accessing energy that is free for the taking. The device is not free, but the source is free: wind, solar, geothermal, tide, and eventually we'll be able to harness things such as zero-point energy and some more things more exotic. That's how you're using the word free energy, right?
That's exactly right. We, you know, God has given us far more energy than we could ever harness, and a lot of it is out there, such as wind and sun, geothermal, all the other sources you mentioned. And there's really no reason not to look at those first as a low-cost, very reliable form of energy. And we should be spending as much time or a lot more money on those things than we are in some of the more mature forms of energy and fossil fuels, which we also need, so that we can really help keep the planet green, but in a very practical way. You know, kind of typically, there's been this struggle going on for many years between those who favor increased environmental activity and those who are concerned about the cost of it, large utility companies and oil and gas companies, all of whom I've worked for in the past. And now I'm very pleased to see that there's this growing middle ground of people saying, wait a minute, we can have something which is reliable and practical and green, but also is economic and makes real good business sense at the same time. And I think we're really seeing a lot of that, particularly with some of the higher costs of fossil fuels over the past few years.
Would you agree with me that if you were to draw two curves on a chalkboard, the lower curve being the price of fuel is an upward sloping curve going kind of up and down depending on, you know, what year in politics that are going on, but generally increasing in cost. The other line would represent the cost of renewable energy, and that curve would be going down, that the cost is getting cheaper as technology increases, as efficiencies increase, and new ways are learned to efficiently harness these technologies. And it seems that there's an intersection, that we're in a region where those are starting to come together, where the price of renewables is coming into the region of the traditional fossil fuel-based energies, so that we're now actually competing one with the other. And if we were to extrapolate into the future 2 to 5 years, we would start finding that the renewable curve is actually going below the continually rising fossil fuel line. Is that correct?
I would agree with that generally, with just a couple of, I think you're right, with a couple of other ways to look at the situation. First, we tend to look, a lot of people do in the energy business, at one part of the energy business, such as what is the cost of production of, let's say, diesel fuel versus solar. In reality, you need to look at the entire system. You really need to do a total life cycle cost analysis to see what the true cost of energy is. And that runs all the way from the production side to the transmission side to the distribution side, to end-use deficiencies, to the impact on health, and all of these other environmental impacts, which are somewhat subtle and harder to analyze, but all of which are really the true cost of energy. Mm-hmm. And into that, you need to add exogenous factors such as what is the value of reliability to a business. If Walmart's computer system goes down, what does that cost? Or even worse, a large bond trading fund on Wall Street. They just can't afford to be out for long periods of time. And when you factor all of those things in, and you get a true picture of energy. One of the analyses that we do, we have a lot of proprietary energy software, and we get a customer, and they say, hey, can you give us reliable power, virtually no maintenance, no fuel, on a mountaintop, you know, somewhere in Central Asia, with a low heat signature, a low radar signature, that will run for many, many years with very little maintenance? And the answer, of course, is yes. But that's what we do. That's one of the things we do. But in addition to that, what's really interesting is when you're dealing in areas like that in the world, the deployed cost, for example, for the military, for fuel in the field, can very easily be $13, $14 a gallon, up to, as I've seen, estimates as high as $300 a gallon and more. So you're not only providing increased reliability, let's say, for forward operating bases for the military, but you're also saving lives because you don't have as many diesel fuel convoys, and you're also saving money. And while being green and being a little bit safer because you don't have that heat signature which can lead to RPGs finding you and the noise that can lead to others finding you more easily. So besides cost, there are many other great advantages that clean green fuels have that are not often considered.
So a military installation with a generator running that is anything but quiet is going to be more dangerous, not only because of the noise that draws attention to it, but also the convoy of oil going back and forth. And we always hear these stories about these convoys being attacked or booby-trapped or whatever. You're eliminating that need. And, of course, a solar panel is much more quiet than a diesel generator.
Well, that's right. Major General Zillmer, who is a Marine Corps general responsible for all of the multinational forces west of Baghdad in Iraq, has called for a large number of sky-built-type units out in the field. And there have been a number of driving forces on that in the military. Certainly, there's been at the top of the Pentagon directives for all of the services to save substantial quantities of fuel. I mean, in 2005, the Department of Defense spent $13 billion on fuel, which is more than the entire nation of Sweden consumed in the same year. And that's only 2% of U.S. overall consumption. So one is you can save costs, which allow the troops to operate far more efficiently because they don't have the great big logistical tail. And the other is saving lives. And IEDs on the road have been a very major concern of the military. And they've spent billions of dollars looking for solutions to IEDs. And one of the solutions is just don't get the convoy out there hauling
IED
the diesel.
IED is what?
I'm sorry?
What's the IED?
Oh, explosive devices that are made by the terrorists to attack U.S. troops in the field.
Okay.
They're called improvised explosive devices, IEDs.
Okay. Well, let's talk for a second about the different plug-and-play components. You were comparing this to the computer industry where you've got a motherboard that has slots that you can plug in a number of different components. And in your situation, the things you have to choose from that I can think of would be a solar panel, a battery storage system, a wind turbine. What would be some of the other plug-and-play components in your system?
Well, what we do, Sterling, is first we start with the customer and find out what their energy need is and where is that going to be and how much energy do they need and what is their low profile, load profile, and so forth. And based on that and their location in particular, we would start to compile what is an optimal system for them. So if you're in the Arctic, for example, you know, in the wintertime, you're going to be looking at a lot more wind, perhaps, than solar. And if you're in Saudi in the summertime or any other time, you'd be more interested in solar. If you're near running water, you'd be interested in micro hydro, for example. A small stream might well be enough to power a micro hydro system. What we typically find is that the best energy solution, even where you have a lot of sun or a lot of wind or whatever, is a combination. And we've become kind of the leading hybrid renewable systems integration company because of our expertise in being able to integrate many kinds of energy and optimize how much power you can get out of each, and then have all of them work together well. It sounds relatively simple, and it is for the user, but to design the system requires a lot of expertise. For example, we work with all manufacturers of all good, reliable products. We have no exclusive arrangements with any solar or wind or battery manufacturer because we're not trying to sell products per se. We're trying to have satisfied customers. And there's always a better product out there just about every day. So we want the flexibility to pick from any commercial, well-proven, off-the-shelf products. When you integrate, for example, solar coming in to a battery bank, along with wind coming in, which is, could be much more intermittent, with an auto start generator and a maximum power point tracker to get more power, where you have variable voltage either with wind or sun. Those are areas where we have a great deal of expertise, so that for the least amount of money, we can help the customer achieve the most amount of power. So just a wide variety of products. In our own systems, it's not just what are the products to produce power, but it's what are the things you can do to reduce parasitic loads in the system. For example, we have a broad range of products. It ranges for all the way from standard freight containers where you put a complete power station in there to trailer-based systems that can be pulled by a Humvee so that you can have instant power out in the field, and that can you can go from a running start out in the field with a Humvee to a power system that'll run for years in less than an hour, and just, you know, the solar's set up, the wind is set up, the batteries, the generator, everything's ready to roll. That's what we do, is rapid deployment.
But that is in contrast to, let's say, a residential or commercial situation where you have to come in and you have to analyze the building and where are we going to install this, on the roof, on the, you know, shed on the back. And this comes as a complete system with wheels if necessary, or in a shipping container that you offload off of a semi, and you put it on the ground, and there it stays, but it's ready to go as soon as it hits the ground, basically, after maybe a couple hours to get things plugged in and whatnot.
That's right. And all depending, for example, we can build a system, let's say, with 20,000 watts of solar power. You know, that one may take a little longer to deploy than one that's, you know, 5,000 watts running a communications or a cell tower, which does not require, you know, that much power.
Uh-huh.
We work with work with manufacturers of all sorts of innovative products. Just talking to a gentleman yesterday we're working with, and they have a 150-foot tower that can be used for communications purposes that we can power. And that tower sets up in an hour or two, 150 feet tall. Now, when you've got that sort of rapid deployment, which is an area of our specialty, that allows you to communicate farther around the curvature of the Earth. When you have a tsunami or a natural disaster, you've got a Katrina situation, first responders will find that sort of thing very useful.
Get the cell phones back up in order, in short order.
That's right. Whenever you have a disaster, a serious natural disaster, the first thing you need is power, and the next thing you need is communications. If people can't talk to each other on the ground and they don't have the power to do that, there's just further chaos. And our systems are designed to solve that problem. And we're working with a number of very large companies to power up their disaster relief operations so that anywhere in the world you can have, for example, lightweight, small, portable, hand-carried power plus communication systems so that you can be satellite linked and you can communicate no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a wide range of and a growing need for super reliable, beyond battery power that can be expanded and used anywhere on the planet.
I'm listening to a documentary right now on Katrina. And that was the primary logjam in Katrina, is they didn't have communication. The people didn't know how bad of a problem they had because their phones were down, and they didn't have their cell phone batteries were dead after a while, and they had no way of conveying to the outside world. And the communications leaders didn't have a way of saying, hey, this police station over here can't communicate with the one across the highway. It was an awful logjam for them, and that was one of the reasons the response was so sluggish there.
Well, and we are involved with a number of major communications companies. You're exactly right. And when the cell towers went down on the Gulf Coast, which is one of the first things the hurricanes took out, think about it. A lot of the power to a lot of things we have in the United States is on the grid. And if you have a tree fall down, 100 miles away, you can have a power interruption that affects hundreds of thousands of people. And when you put distributed generation power at the power site rather than relying on long transmission lines, it makes the entire system more reliable. Even when the lines don't go down, the lines are not so stressed because you've got power where you need it the most, which is often at the end of the line where there's the least power available. But in Katrina, for example, one of the problems, as you say, was the cell companies went in there and they do what they do very well. They sent in diesel generators and they sent in fuel, hundreds of diesel generators and lots of fuel. But the roads were blocked and frequently the fuel never got to the generators. Well, one of our mobile power stations in a container can be pre-positioned on site or brought in on a flatbed truck or a simple tow truck that tows your car, or lots of other ways, by a helicopter if necessary, and by train or airplane or C-130 or, any way you want. They're waterproof. Freight containers fall off ships in the North Atlantic, so they're like icebergs. So even if it got loose down the Mississippi River, you could pull it to shore and your power station would still be running. And you open it up, you deploy solar and wind and other things we have, and now you have instant power, very reliable. When you have a hurricane, you have strong winds frequently before, after, and during. So wind turbines are great with it as well as solar. We've developed...
Now, are they going to stand up to a gust of wind?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we have throw out solar, flexible solar panels, so you don't even need a structure. You just throw it out on the ground, anchor it if you want to, or leave it on the ground, drive a truck over it, and you can deploy, 1,000 watts every 2 minutes, right on the ground, plug it into one of our systems. And with that in place, you can put a communications tower up there, and now you're satellite linked. And the inside of our containers can be heated, air-conditioned. You can put people in them. It can be an emergency op center, a rescue center, a clinic, whatever you need. It could be a you know, place for distance learning anywhere on the planet in the developing areas where they need classrooms, but they don't have a library and they want to be linked to the Internet as a library. So we offer a lot of flexibility.
Now, one of the things you mentioned there is the you're talking about bringing in the container before the incident actually hits, such as in Katrina, where we have National Weather Service gives us a pretty good idea where the things can make landfall, and you've got a number of hours to work with before all hell breaks loose, so to speak, and so you could deploy these, or you could actually drop these things strategically where you think they're going to be needed, and then once the storm passes, you've got just a couple hours and you're ready to rock and roll.
You're exactly right. There ought to be hundreds of these pre-positioned around the United States in areas that are really subject to hurricanes and other disasters, in the same way that the Red Cross and others pre-position medical supplies, food, water, and blankets, because these things are just as important. You've got to have the power there.
Well, in a case where you don't see it coming, and let's say, and you haven't, I mean, New Orleans knew it was going to come, and the documentary I'm listening to on tape is telling a really sad story about how they did not adequately prepare, even though they knew that it wasn't a matter of if, but when. They knew that if they got hit with a Category 3 to 5, that they would be in a really bad way. If they had flooding, et cetera, the scenarios were all played out routinely in the news, and they were given money, and they squandered it. They spent it on other things than what it was earmarked for. And so when the big one hit, they were not ready. And so let's say you've got a situation like that, or a tsunami comes, and, you know, this unforeseen situation, and the roads are blocked. Would you be ready, let's say something like that happened today, and somebody wanted one of these emergency deployment situations, how would you deliver these? And would they be ready to go?
Well, we don't have a large inventory of these. We are currently building, of course, power stations for various customers. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't take long. What we do is we use only off-the-shelf proven commercial components. So, and then we apply the proprietary. We filed over 140 patent claims relating to rapid deployment of renewable energy systems, and we apply ways to make these things connect up quickly and go together. And basically, we can assemble these very rapidly. We are working with the military on, some of their needs, of course, as to how to get more rapidly deployable power out in the field quickly. And so we have a lot of ramp-up capability. As far as how do you get them there, even before you do that, one of the interesting things is if they were pre-positioned. Here is a power station that's got clean, green, renewable energy 24/7. You can plug that into the grid even while it's in storage and waiting to be used. Let's say there's a Air Force or military base or any other government installation or commercial installation. You put a bunch of those out in the field, plug them in to the grid and sell green power into the grid, and whoever owns them, and we can sell our products or lease them to third parties, can get tax credits and for selling green energy. So
you've got your emergency energy generation capability producing electricity during non-emergency times, and then when the emergency comes, it's ready to be used for its emergency application.
Yeah, this is one of the few products that makes money while it's in storage.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to the situation where we were talking about, let's say, Katrina, and the roads are down. Would you be ready to, what would it take to be capable to drop one of these things from the air? and buy it on parachute.
Rather than if you're in the U.S., what would make more sense rather than drop them from a parachute would be just bring them in by helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And they can easily be slung under a helicopter, and then you bring it in and drop it down, and there's no danger that it may land in the wrong place or whatever. Mm-hmm. When you're doing airdrops, let's say with laser-guided parachutes and other high-tech things, it's not something you want to do over the middle of New Orleans. So there, you could put in an area like that, you could put them on a barge, you could bring them in by barge and hook them up on shore with a wire going to shore. You could bring them in just with a standard tow truck if the roads are available. Or obviously by a flat car on a train, whatever way you want. And as a last resort, if you have to bring it by air because it's more expensive that way to get a helicopter or whatever, that's easily done.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about ramp up, the military application, for example, where they've got maybe a conflagration, a war situation that has escalated and they need a sudden influx of these types of capabilities, would you deploy or would you assemble those here and then ship them, or would you actually have the capability remotely to, let's say, assemble, a few hundred miles away as opposed to a few thousand miles away?
Well, we're in discussions with folks who would like to have us, under license, build these products in various places around the world. If there were a large market, let's say, we were asked by the president of Ethiopia to help him design very inexpensive water pumping systems for remote villages, and we have signed an agreement to do the first of those villages in Ethiopia. In a case where there are many units that are needed over a long period of time, our choices would be, and this would, we'd be happy to work with the customer on any of a number of alternatives. One approach is, they need something, we have them, and they're in a hurry, we just ship them. Another approach would be that they may want, as a part of sustainable economic development, let's say in Africa or Central Asia where we are doing things, to say, look, we'd like to have you come over or train our people, maybe open a factory, and why not build them over there, because that way you can employ local people and help the economy there. And where those sorts of things are more complicated, a little more difficult, but, things are possible if all of the pieces fit on the business side.
When you talk about you can assemble these things rapidly, how rapid are we talking about? How many units of, say, 5 kilowatts could you throw together in a day?
Well, it all depends. For example, let's say you want 5 kilowatts of solar power.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want a structure. You've got a communications facility, and you just want 5 kW of instantly or rapidly deployable solar that you could, deploy out there in an hour or less. In a case like that, it would be relatively simple. We've got those products. If we know, how many units people need and so forth, we can arrange to get them there. Or we can make more if we need to. And those sorts of things can, if we have enough advance notice, it's a matter of ordering the components from the, various component manufacturers, those that manufacture PV, integrating them into the, fold-out type canvas systems that we have, and shipping them. So it's relatively straightforward. Most of it is really supply-side logistics. Every manufacturing operation has a queue, and these days people don't warehouse lots of things. They want just in-time delivery to keep their operating costs and product costs down. So the answer is, if there's there's a customer that is able to tell us how many and when they want them and so forth, I think it's pretty likely we would be able to find some way to satisfy their needs.
All right.
On higher-end, more complicated products, frequently what happens is we'll have a customer that comes in and says, I've got a very interesting requirement here. We need to have something that's, you know, heated, air-conditioned, has a lot of control things, super reliability, needs to go in an extremely harsh climate, things like that. Well, those will take a little bit longer. But we run all the way from very simple, low-cost systems that can be used in the developing world, where there's, you know, money is a real serious problem and people are really suffering, and we try to do everything we can to help these people, to highly sophisticated, much more expensive products.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been doing this, and how many have you cranked out?
Well, we started the company about 3 years ago, and I was kind of started over lunch. I was having lunch with an old colleague, friend of mine, Scott Sklar, who was one of the early founders of the Solar Energy Industry Trade Association, and he actually ran it as executive director for many years, and he started one of the founders, I think, of Bioenergy Association, and also ran that. And Scott and I were sort of musing about, you know, what's wrong out there? Why isn't more of this solar and wind being developed? So we decided to, start a company to do it over lunch, and we said, well, let's first do a worldwide search of intellectual property to see if anybody else had done the sorts of things we were thinking of doing as far as plug and play, expandable, use anybody's product type devices. And strangely enough, they had not. Perhaps it was too obvious. And in the history of the energy industry, as you know, it tends to be tunneled. The nuclear people do not spend too much time talking to wind or solar or natural gas or whatever. Everybody tends to be, to some extent, in their own silo. And even more than that, the energy industry people tend to, in the renewables business, tend to do a lot in laboratories trying to get the price down as low as they can, for example, for solar, so it can get as close to, you know, the price of grid as possible. What that means is that there's not a lot of crosstalk. You know, thankfully, your program and your website really helped to facilitate that, but there's not been a lot of crosstalk among various kinds of energy. And the renewables have sort of been out there. And so we had all had experience in solar and wind and coal and oil and gas and electricity and so forth. So we found it a little bit easier to build a really good team of experts, including people like the former head of renewables, if you will, for the U.S. Army, who had written virtually every major report for the Pentagon over many years on how to incorporate renewables and pros and cons of them versus, you know, fuel-based systems, and hired another engineer who would put solar on the Pentagon and at CIA and probably installed as many solar and wind and, you know, geothermal systems as just about anyone. And really good experts like that, and created the company, built our first mobile power station because we wanted to show people that it was really pretty simple. It took a lot of money and a lot of very smart engineering to make it as dumb and reliable as we possibly could.
Uh-huh.
I used to play with Tinker Toys as a kid, and my model is something just as simple as that for the customer, so that you plug the red part into the red slot, and you're done, and it works. And so we modeled the company that way. We don't publicize how many we're building or of anyone type and all that. It's a privately held company, so we don't go that route. But, it'd be safe to say that there have been some things which have been made public. We're under contract with the Army, as you may have seen in the press, to build some things for them, and we have a development agreement, and one of our investors is Incutel, the CIA CIA's venture capital firm, and we have done things for the intelligence community. We're doing other things as well.
What about Red Cross?
Excuse me, Red Cross?
Yeah.
We are not working with the Red Cross at the moment. Would be very pleased to work with them. And they they do a wonderful job, and they certainly are experts in going into areas and, you know, really getting things going and things back to normal as quickly as possible.
Any other first response companies, local governments?
We are talking to many. There are a number of organizations, including Booz Allen Hamilton, SAIC, IBM, Cisco, and others, that we are in discussions with on best ways to provide emergency relief power and communication systems. For example, with one of those companies, we are discussing a whole new line of equipment for first responders, so that no matter where you are on the planet, you would have the capability to be able to communicate. In the international community, there's a huge amount of interest in, you know, the sorts of power we can provide. I had a visit Friday, this past Friday. Three people showed up at my office and who were very well connected. One is directly related to the president of one of the African countries, saying, "Hey, can you help to link up, various critical facilities in our country? And we don't want to go to poles and wires on the electric side, and we want to go green." And there's just a lot of interest, and we're talking to lots of folks in a lot of different markets.
Now, satellite hookup for communications can be very expensive. Do you have a way to get around that expense, or are you tied into that? Basically, in an emergency situation where you've got to communicate, then you're willing to foot that kind of expense.
Yeah, that you're exactly right. There's, as you know, there's a tremendous issue in regard to bandwidth, both in the military and the civilian markets, and it is expensive. And there are more satellites going up, but it's in relatively short supply and high demand. And we do not have a way around that, except that, as you say, when you're in an emergency situation, the cost of that kind of communication is often far less than not keeping any of the critical facilities up and running, which can cost, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in a very short period of time in the business community.
Mm-hmm. Now, in an emergency situation such as 9/11, which is obviously an off-the-charts type of scenario, but it has happened and could happen again, you've got an overwhelm of the communication system. You've got everyone and their dog using their cell phone, and it takes 100 calls before you get through. How is satellite able to handle those types of overwhelm situations?
I'm not a satellite expert, but what little I have seen in that field, and of course we're on the power side, what we do is we work with partners on the communications side, and I leave the details of that pretty much to them. But one of the systems, one of the partners we were working with the other day was explaining how if you're in a particular area of the country, one of the tricks is to get out of that particular area code that you're in, because there are so many calls jammed up in that area code, and hop over that area code to an area code that might be nearby, which is unaffected by the disaster, where there's excess capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some very innovative electronic switching systems that have the capability to scan surrounding area codes and find ones that are not jammed up, and then send the signal directly into those area codes and hop over the logjam. And then from there you can do a landline, and you might not have to go to satellite, for example.
So one of your systems, electrical components, might be an array of cell phones that are tied into regional removed but not far removed area codes. I know my cell phone's locked into this area code here, but if I was setting up an emergency setup, I could have some of the local area codes hooked up in my setup. And would that be a way of working around it?
As I say, I'm not the person who would know the answer to that, but from what little I have seen with some of these worldwide communications companies, and I've been at their facilities talking with them, they have things that can not only do that, but can do pretty much whatever needs to be done in order to get through log jams. I was talking with one of them last week who is the head of Worldwide Disaster disaster recovery systems for a major communications company, and he was telling me how when the cable broke over in the southeast, over in the far east, how many cables, I think three or four cables or something like that, were down, and how they routed the calls all across Asia back through Europe, and they know how to do that. And our job is to give them the power they need so that they can keep all that going.
Mm-hmm. Another question, a big question I wanted to address as we start wrapping it up here. One of the questions that you will be facing on an ongoing basis is new types of efficient power. You talked about how you're not locking into any one particular supplier with an exclusive so that you have flexibility to go with whatever is most efficient. What do you do to keep yourself abreast of what's new and what's coming down?
Well, that's an excellent question, Sterling, and we all struggle with that. We have engineers who were very well plugged in all directions to different kinds of technology. Fortunately, we have your website and, have all of the good information you provide. You're I think, one of the most valuable sources out there. We are constantly talking to people and we're ending up in being sort of a hub, if you will, of seeing some of the best ideas coming in. Because of what we're doing under some of our large contracts, we have a lot of people who are developing products coming to us and saying, I've got this new product, we're going to be, able to produce it over the next year. And we have ways of working with others who might be interested. We sometimes talk to venture capital firms. We look at what some of these new products are before anybody hears about them. We try them out at our facilities. And so we're finding out not just from the public sources, but also from people who say, wait a minute, I've got a product that I think would be great for you guys to use. Can I come by and show it to you? Somebody just brought me up one last week. I spent 3 hours with them. I'd never seen before, and it's one that we may well be using.
Would you anticipate a time that your system becomes so efficient cost-wise that it might actually go outside of the emergency first responder, emergency quick deployment market and actually go to similar to the PC where it becomes a ubiquitous type of scenario?
I would hope that's the case. Where you're talking, a couple of dollars a gallon for diesel fuel, for example, in a remote area, we already are less expensive on a life cycle basis. Of course, we're more expensive up front. But after a couple of years, our systems can pay for themselves with that sort of, for example, cost for diesel. If you're in the United States and your alternative is, let's say, the grid, there are certainly times, peak days in, let's say, even New Jersey in the summertime where the cost of the power by wire could far exceed what our cost could be because we have virtually no maintenance and no fuel. So once the first cost is taken care of, either by purchasing our equipment or by a lease, there may well be some times when we can you know, save money there. Mm-hmm. But we're just looking, for example, solar, you know, flexible solar products are in the neighborhood of maybe 10% or so efficiency. There are some new ones we're looking at that are as high as 20%. Those sorts of orders of magnitude of change in the prices can, you know, offer a lot of hope for us in the future.
I should mention that SkyBuilt is listed on our top 100 energy technologies and has been there, I think, from the first time we started there. I remember your company actually put out a press release mentioning that at one time, and that actually, I did a Google search one time, and that press release was picked up by quite a few news services.
Well, it was probably the good way that you wrote some of the things that you've said about us in the past, which we certainly appreciate. But we are fortunate, I think all of us are, being at that point in history where a lot of innovative, new, clean, green energy solutions are not only making a lot of sense on a lot of levels, but also can be very good business decisions.
Yeah, we are coming into a time when it's not, you don't have to make a choice between green or conscience versus economics, that it's starting to become economical to go green.
Absolutely, and there will probably come a point at which, you know, you'll find public service commissions asking more and more of the utilities, why aren't you buying more green power? Why aren't you buying more reliable power? Why aren't you buying a lot of different sources? And having worked with various kinds of power, I always kind of keep in mind that we need all the kinds of power out there, not just green power, but, you know, we need nuclear and oil and coal and gas, and each, there's no perfect power. Everyone has its pros and cons. But what we need to do is make sure we don't neglect looking at the opportunities that you've got in green energy, and let's get some more technology out there and some more good products, and it will take care of itself pretty well.
Do you anticipate a time that the renewable energy industry in general will actually make their products plug and playable into your system as a tower of sorts, like the tower of a PC? You know, somebody that comes out with a card for some kind of let's say a game, for example, they would make their card that is a PCI compatible, plugs into a motherboard. Do you anticipate that the industry will actually make their systems that they can plug into the SkyBuilt motherboard, so to speak?
Well, we have a power panel, usually, for example, on the outside of our containers or trailer-based systems or handheld systems. And that takes anything from a NATO connector to any sort of NEMA connector, any kind of a standard connector you have to transfer power. And you can jumpstart the battery on a Humvee, or a Humvee can feed the batteries in one of our containers. And so we're already on or off grid compatible, and we can do any voltage type systems from, you know, 12 to 24 to, you know, whatever. And we can do, you know, dual hertz systems where if one of our customers says, hey, I want a system that'll handle a disaster from Katrina to Afghanistan. You know, as you know, that part of the world's got 50 hertz, and we've got, you know, we've got 60 over here. And our systems automatically sense that. And so they're very much compatible. As far as plugging cards in, sure, we could do that.
Anything we've not covered that you want to bring up? One thing really quick I can think of, I know you're a privately held company. If somebody who's interested in investing in the company, what do they do?
Well, they could contact me as you probably know, for legal reasons and so forth. You know, we're not going to get into that. But if they have any questions, they can feel free. First, I would think, check our website, which is skybuilt.com, SkyBuilt.com. There's a lot of information there about us and our products. And there'll be contact phone numbers there depending on what sort of questions anybody might have, and we'll be very pleased to, you know, talk to any of your listeners or anybody else anytime.
Well, thanks, Dave, for coming on. I appreciate your time and the information you've provided. Wish you the best of luck in your continuing of pushing the envelope and the availability of renewable power.
Well, thanks for all that you do to help all of us understand all the new developments out there.
All right. Take care.
Okay, Sterling. Bye-bye.
Bye.